Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
CBS, Eye on the World, Behind the Black. Bob Zimmerman is here. I'm John Batchelor. And Starliner, Boeing-built Starliner, a capsule updated for the 21st century, except, Bob, a very good evening to you. You have been very careful in explaining to me that ULA launching Starliner is a first-rate organization from the 20th century. Starliner is in the 21st. They have not launched Starliner with two people on board because of a valve problem. Please explain to the audience what happens next.
Yes, this valve problem is something that is not unusual for an Atlas V rocket launch, ULA launch. For the upper stage especially, they use hydrogen fuel. And hydrogen is very hard to control. And so periodically when they do it, when they close a valve in the fueling process, this happens in ordinary situations in our homes. The valve closes, but it doesn't sit exactly right. And when it does, you get flutter. You know, the valve keeps opening and closing as, you know, think of your boiling water, but you have a top on the pot. And you know how the steam will like bubble out the edge and the pot top will kind of flutter about. Well, that's kind of what they had here because it didn't sit well. It wasn't seated well. And so in a normal unmanned launch of an Atlas V rocket, all the mission control engineers would do is they'd open the valve and close it again, and it would then sit properly, and everything would be fine. And as the CEO of ULA, Tory Bruno, said in the press conference, if this was an unmanned satellite, that satellite would already be in orbit. Because this is not a big problem, it's just sometimes the valves don't sit right. And so you have to open and close them. But we don't open and close a valve when there's people on the rocket, because this rocket was originally designed not for manned launch. So we fuel everything. They fuel everything before the people get on board, and then they freeze the fueling process. They don't want to change the fueling status while people are on board. And there's complicated reasons for that. For example, the Centaur upper stage is designed to have fuel in it to pressurize it. If you take the fuel out, the shape of the rocket actually changes because the skin is so thin. And so this is an issue that when it's unmanned launches, it's not as big a deal to worry about. But when people on board, they don't want to take a chance, and so they don't change the valve. So when this happened, they had no choice. They said, basically, we've got to unfuel the rocket. We've got to check the status of this valve. And the valve is going to be fine, but when it's fluttering, it's literally doing an open and close, open and close, open and close. And that means it might have exceeded its lifespan in the number of times it's done that. And if that's the case, even if it's totally good, they will replace the valve. Now, none of the replacements are a problem, but what that means is that the launch didn't occur at the start of this week, and they've now rescheduled tentatively for the end of this week, May 10th. But that date is not firm yet because it does depend on what they find with the valve, whether they have to replace it or not. NASA and everyone involved with ISS had arranged the docking and undocking procedures at the station to get everything out of the way. There's no more other mission going to ISS until August. So they have plenty of time. They've given a great window for this mission to launch because it's a first manned mission. So they're going to be careful. And if there's scrubs, they want to give themselves time to do it. So they're in good shape in that respect. This is Starliner, which has had many years of problems. It's 4 years behind schedule. Boeing's quality control issues continue to have plagued it. But this scrub has nothing to do with Boeing. The capsule was not the problem. And the problem itself with ULA is not a quality control thing. If anything, it's them doing their job right.
Do we need Starliner?
Absolutely, we need Starliner for multiple reasons. NASA wants to have redundancy. They want to have two different vehicles to bring things on board ISS in case one has a failure. The American rocket industry, space industry, needs two competitive manned capsules to bring competition to the industry to lower costs. Boeing is not going to be a great competitor because people are going to be not trustworthy about using it until they've proven it for a while. But nonetheless, that's what we want. We want to have competition. We want to have multiple capsules being able to launch with people on board. It is interesting, John, that competition issue and the trust of Boeing has come up with Russia. Russia has a barter deal with NASA whereby for every astronaut they put on a Dragon capsule, Russia puts on a Dragon capsule, NASA can put an American astronaut on a Soyuz capsule. And what that does is they by having Americans and Russians fly on each other's capsules, it helps spread the knowledge about how they all work, and they want to have that. So when the Starliner begins to fly operationally, it's going to alternate flights with SpaceX's Dragon. But the Russians have basically told NASA, we're not going to fly our Russian astronauts on the Starliner initially. We will want to see one or two flights go first before we'll take it. And this has to do. They did the same thing, by the way, with Dragon. And there were reasons then, because SpaceX had never flown anything manned before. But with Boeing, it's not just simply that. It has to do with quality control concerns at Boeing. So the Russians are going to hold off. They're not going to start buying. But once they start buying tickets or flying to astronauts on Starliner, we might get to a point where others will consider flying on Starliner. And at that point, we'd have a real competitive manned space industry.
One more difficult question. Do we trust Boeing to reproduce this capsule without trouble? In other words, it needs an assembly line. You've taught me that.
That's a good question. Well, remember, they designed Starliner to be like Dragon, reusable. Of course, it's going to take a lot of flights to get to the point where they can reuse it. Do we trust them? I can't answer that question, John. That's a good question, and that's the bottom line question. And in fact, that's why the Russians are holding off, and that's probably why tourists will hold off flying on Starliner, because they want to see if Boeing does get their attack together to do this right.
We move to SpaceX, which is happy. And a spacesuit that looks something like a Power Ranger, if you're familiar with that, and something like a stormtrooper from Star Wars, although this would be an officer class, not the plebes. Were you impressed, Bob?
Well, yes, but for not different reasons. The look of all the SpaceX's spacesuits has never impressed me, but I'm impressed for other reasons. And this relates to Starliner, in fact. Remember, I said Boeing's got to prove before it's operationally good before the private people will buy tickets. Well, here's a case where SpaceX has a private space program, not just a private flight, being put together by Gerard Isaacman. He's the guy who flew already once before on an orbital mission on a Dragon. He's put together a three-flight program that he's going to do with SpaceX, and the first flight is called Polaris Dawn. And that flight is supposed to have the first private citizen spacewalk. It was originally going to launch in 22, but they realized they had to develop the hatch to open on the Dragon capsule so that it would be able to open and then close. And they had to develop spacesuits that the whole crew could wear when the hatch is open. There's no airlock, so when the hatch is open, all the air in the capsule goes away. And so everyone, even those that aren't doing the spacewalk, have got to be in a spacesuit that can be in space. And so developing that suit has taken time, and it's delayed the mission. They're now scheduling this flight with Isaacman's spacewalk for this summer. And what happened this week, past weekend, is SpaceX unveiled the upgraded flight suits that are now space suits for spacewalking this past week, and they unveiled them. And yes, they have, as always, they're trying to get them a cool look. But the main issue is the flight suits they've been using on their manned launches are basically suits that if this capsule lost air, they would be able to survive. But they're not designed to do a spacewalk. You don't have much capabilities. They're basically sitting in a balloon. And they've upgraded this so that the spacesuit now allows mobility and motion and flexibility, and they can function in it. And so it allows them to do a spacewalk. And so that's now ready. And what makes this especially impressive is that it took 2 years for SpaceX to develop this, but it's done it faster than the two private companies NASA has hired to build spacesuits for its Artemis program. Both Axiom and Collins have a contract for the last year and a half, 2 years, and they yet have not finished their suits. They're developing them, and they'll build them much faster and cheaper than NASA was trying to do. NASA spent 14 years and more than almost $2 billion and never got past PowerPoint presentations. So they're going to build suits, but SpaceX really impresses here with how quickly they got this suit going. So now SpaceX has got manned capsules. It's got a rocket that's it's building a rocket that might get to Mars very soon. And it's got spacesuits. All the ingredients for a private colonization of the solar system at SpaceX are being put in place, John.
All right. Bob Zimmerman, henceforth to be known as a Musk whisperer, he's going to explain to us why it is that Musk is now telling us he does not use AI for Starlink and SpaceX. Okay, Musk whisperer, what is the explanation?
I'm not whispering. This is something he said at a conference. He was asked questions. And he spent a lot of time waxing eloquently about the wonders that will come from artificial intelligence. Quote, he said, a truth-seeking IA could foster human civilization in the future and make everyone's lives better. Spent a lot of time doing this. And then they asked him, do you use IA at SpaceX or at Starlink? And he said, well, quote, oddly enough, one of the areas where there's almost no AI used is space exploration. SpaceX and Starlink do not use AI. I'm not against using it. We just haven't seen a use for it. And then he went on to talk about how he started to ask his AI language some questions about space. And for every one of those questions, quote, AI has been terrible at all these questions, close quote. And here we see the visionary meeting the practical engineering businessman, Musk. He's definitely a visionary. He's always thinking about, you know, settling other planets, living on Mars, making the human race multiplanetary so it can survive in case one planet goes out. But when he actually comes time to actually build the things that will make the visions happen, he becomes extremely practical and hard-nosed. And if it ain't going to work, he ain't going to use it. And so he looked at IA, and he realized it's basically still garbage in, garbage out. The rush to use it by businesses and tech firms has actually been blind and stupid. It's resulted in a lot of disasters already. But Musk doesn't do that. He doesn't do it blindly. He tested it. He found it wanting, and he put it aside, even though he believes someday it'll do wonderful things. And this is why Musk is successful, because he doesn't follow his fantasies blindly. He has his fantasies or his dreams, and then he figures out in the real world what will work to build it. And AI is not the thing to use right now for most things. And he's realized that, and he doesn't do it, even though he thinks it's wonderful.
What is High Impulse?
High Impulse is one of three German rocket startups that are pushing very hard to get their first orbital launches in the next year or so. High Impulse this past weekend completed its first suborbital test launch from the Southern Launch Spaceport on the south coast of Australia. It was a suborbital launch. It's a small test rocket, but they completed it, and that allows them to test their fuels, their engine, and a lot of other parts of the rocket. And it also allowed Southern Launch to initiate its private spaceport on the south of Australia. So they've moved forward. The other two rocket companies are all moving to do test launches, they hope, before the end of this year or next year. And so Germany has got a rocket industry.
You know, when Europe got involved, Bob, initially, remember, it was Luxembourg was the first that I remember. Luxembourg sort of poked its finger in with its sovereign fund and started investing. Now it looks like a waterfall of companies.
Yes. Yes. Luxembourg's been around actually for more than 20 years in the satellite industry. That's where they focused. And they made a lot of money in the satellite industry. Their company is SES. It just purchased Intelsat, the American company. It really is a very successful company. But in terms of rocketry, what Europe has done for decades has been put together a consortium in the European Space Agency called Arianespace to build government rockets. And that model basically kind of worked. It never made money, but it kind of worked for decades. But in the new competitive private industry, capitalism industry, it doesn't work anymore. And so all these European companies now are shifting to the private model, capitalism in space. And part of the reason they're doing it is because Arianespace's Ariane 6 rocket is really a failure. It's not reusable. It's too expensive. It involves too much politics within the government to get it built. If you have private companies, they don't have those problems, and that's why we're seeing this war.
What this reminds me of, Bob, is early days of building aeronautics. Early days.
Yeah, that's right.
When the best engineering was in the U.S., and so when the Russians wanted to find out what they needed to build, Stalin sent them to America, to MIT, to spy on the building of our aircraft. And then they took those secrets home. They could have waited 10 years, and Harry Hopkins would have given them anything for a lend-lease. But that's what this looks like. They're all going to be coming to America and recruiting out of our engineering teams to take back to Germany or Japan or Indonesia, wherever they're going.
I'm not so sure, John, on that. I mean, Germany has got these three companies because there's a very, 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 very deep engineering base in Europe, not just Germany, in Europe. That's why Spain has a rocket company, and it didn't come from America. Ideas are coming from America, concepts. A lot of the engineering is being used that's been developed in America. But the people are coming from Europe because they have a good engineering base, a good technology personnel base. But they've wasted it for decades with a government model, just like we did. And that's changing now. And because that's changing, you're suddenly seeing a birth of a new industry very fast.
Bob Zimmerman, Behind the Black. We're going to Mars. I'm John Beck.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.